Welcome to Lit from the Basement. This is Danielle.
This is Max.
I'm an author and professor.
After getting a high score on an arcade machine, I was recruited to become the last starfighter and defend the frontier from the Kodan Armada. Now I'm a stay-at-home dad.
We're a married couple who discuss literature in our basement while our children are sleeping. Our show is pretty simple. I introduce my poetry-resistant husband to a poem, which we use as a springboard for conversation in the 1 hour we have to ourselves in the evening.
The boys are now asleep.
So let's talk.
Let's get the clock running on this hour.
So this week is winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere. It'll be on Friday, December 21st. And since it's the longest night of the year, I thought I'd share a long meditative nocturne from Paisley Rectall's fourth collection of poetry, Animal Eye.
What is a nocturne in reference to poetry?
Oh, yeah. Good question. A nocturne people usually think of as musical form. Yeah. So a nocturne or night scene is a poem that is set at night and expresses the mood that arises from that. It's usually pretty moody. It shares a term with the musical form, which is also pensive and melancholy, musical piece, usually for the piano. And for that reason, authors of nocturnes usually evoke the same tone in the poetic form. It's thoughtful, it's slow, and it's moody.
Real quick, when you're saying tone, you mean like emotional tone, or are you?
Yes.
Are you, okay.
Yeah. There's no particular form to it in the poetic sense.
Okay.
Only in the
just the mood.
Yeah, kind of. It's the mood, and it takes place at night.
Okay.
And so I wanted a poem that takes place entirely in night and sort of evokes this thoughtful, meditative, slow sense. And since it's the longest night of the year, you know, it'll give you something to think about in those dark hours. That's more beauty than dark. So for those of you who don't know Paisley Rectall, she's a really lauded and prolific writer. She has actually 3 books of nonfiction and currently 5, soon to be 6, poetry collections.
Working on an opera too, right?
Yeah, like, that's what she's saying on Facebook.
I saw something.
A libretto.
Okay.
Yeah, for an opera, I believe. I believe she's not writing the musical part of an opera. I think it's
Why not? Just throw that on too.
I think she's just writing a libretto for an opera. You know, something everybody can do. she's received many prestigious awards, including the Guggenheim, the Fulbright, the Amy Lowell Traveling Fellowship, the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. And in 2017, she was named Utah's Poet Laureate. And she also teaches in the doctoral program for creative writing at the University of Utah, where she was my professor.
Okay. That's where you guys crossed paths.
Yes. Her 6th poetry collection will be out with Copper Canyon Press in May 2019. The title of that book is Nightingale, which is the same title as today's poem from her previous collection, Animal Eye.
We do a lot of Copper Canyon.
I know. We don't mean to.
We get nothing from them.
I know. We get nothing
do
from
we?
Them. But Animal Eye isn't from Copper Canyon. It's from University of Pittsburgh Press.
Oh, so what's your...
The poem that we're discussing today is from Animal Eye.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One of the things that
I
made
thought it was
going
to be like the titular poem of an upcoming book, but no. Okay.
No, sorry. Yeah. The upcoming book is called Nightingale. And when she posted the beautiful new cover that's coming out in the spring, you know, and I saw the title of it, I was like, oh, Nightingale. I love that poem from Animal Eye. That's one I want to talk about for winter solstice. So I immediately thought back to this particular poem, which is one of my favorites from the collection. She was on my dissertation committee, and I wrote about 100 pages of my memoir, The Riots, in her classes, in her class. And it was also in that course that I had one of the most tense and bizarre classroom experiences ever, having nothing to do with Paisley, who's completely lovely.
It sounds like you're about to tell us.
Yes. So this is a doctoral course in creative nonfiction, and there were only 5 people in the course, all women. Paisley decided that we'd take turns meeting at each other's house each week. So on rotation, every 6th class, we would gather at Paisley's. We're always pretty excited about that. I mean, it's kind of silly because we are all grown women, like in our late 20s, early 30s. But we're like, oh, we're going to Paisley's house.
That's still, I mean, I remember that from grad school.
Right?
Yeah. That's yeah. still exciting. You feel, I mean, it's silly, but it's still so
Yeah. It's also just really endearing. We're like, oh, we want to be really smart in this conversation yeah. and
but also,
show our appreciation. And she always had fabulous snacks for us. And we sat around in her living room
and
talking.
And it's a very exclusive meeting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. So we'd been listening to some audio essays in the class, and Paisley had arranged for one of the authors of these audio essays to come talk with us, and we were really excited about it. She went out of her way to find somebody who was local, who had published, broadcasted his essay on some national venues, and we were really excited about meeting him. And, you know, Paisley probably communicated with him over email and could not have foreseen how completely insane he was.
Delicious.
So she's done this amazing thing, like gone out of her way to find somebody local who has published in a national venue who's going to come talk to us, right? About
is this also her first time meeting this guy face to face?
Yes.
And it's in her house.
In her house. Right. Okay. So here's the thing about Paisley, though. She has one of the most beautiful professional performances of anybody I can think of. And I say professional performance with love. She's extremely smart. She's very quick-witted. And she's really good at maintaining boundaries without being cold or off-putting in any way. She really uses her wit to turn around any situation, to misdirect anything that might turn into tense. She's masterful at it, right? So the guy shows up, I think about 40 minutes late, a little bit drunk.
Okay, well, that's to be expected.
And with a date.
Oh, wait.
They seemingly had met at the venue they were at before. I don't know if it was a party or just a bar. And he sort of picked her up.
He's like, hey, come with me, doll. I'm going to show you people showering attention on me.
Yes. Now, she turned out to be very interesting and cool. Mm-hmm. And you could tell as soon as she they were laughing as they walked through the door. And when they walked through the door, he didn't look fazed at all. But she was like, where are we?
She read the room.
Yeah. She read the room. He did not. Mm. He didn't care about reading the room. Right. So he comes in on this gliding through blah, blah, blah. Like kind of drunk with this woman, and all of us are sort of looking at each other like, did he bring a date to our class? what is happening right now? Paisley's being amazing, right? She looks slightly concerned, but she's really good at keeping a calm demeanor and just tries to immediately sort of engage him in some of the questions that we may have asked, you know, about his work in radio and how he composed his essays and like, what is the process for blah, blah, blah. He keeps deviating from any answer in order to variously, sometimes outwardly and sometimes surreptitiously insult everybody.
How awesome. What a swell fella.
And the woman that he's with seems to be like more and more concerned, she just looks a little bit bewildered. And at one point she's like trying to be social and she's like, so, how do you all know each other? You know, because he has told her nothing clearly about what
she's
this
like, what
is.
What have I walked into?
Exactly. And we're like, we're a class that he's visiting for the doctoral program. He's like, you don't need a doctoral degree for writing. Like, you know, and somebody's like, well, I guess I'll just drop out. He's like, you should, you know, like this sort of thing. At one point, you know, she's like, well, what is the class about? Like, oh, it's a creative nonfiction class. She was like, oh, creative nonfiction. That's right up my alley. Like I do some documentary work and was interested in the story of the women at Juarez doing some serious work on that.
Such an uplifting story.
Well, I mean, so she says this and he immediately throws his hands up like as if he's swatting flies away from himself, right? And is like, oh, who cares about that sad feminist shit?
What? And to a room full of women in a doctoral program.
Yes. And and you know,
is there a remote possibility I'm asking as younger jackass drunk me,
mm-hmm.
is there a way he's just trying to be incendiary by,
no.
by way of, no, he's actually believe. Okay.
Yes,
never mind.
He believes what he says.
Okay. Never mind.
Yeah. And so I can't remember, like, we, you know, we sort of like everybody paused and then somebody was like, I don't think the murdering of several people is only a feminist issue. I think it's a humanitarian issue. Certainly there are misogynist reasons behind that. And he just like, oh, come on, let's talk about something else. And like throws off. I don't exactly.
Let's talk about the Utah Jazz.
Yeah,
their rebound game's amazing.
No, I was just like, oh my God, what is
wow.
happening? Paisley was amazing and kept trying to bring it back to like something intellectual that we could talk about. She did gracefully get them out of the house.
And a cab for him.
Something.
He walked out with some of her silverware and a bottle.
I mean, one would think. And she like closed.
But not before he probably said some of the effect of, where's your crapper?
Right. That's like basically the whole thing, right? You know, Paisley like shuts the door and turns to apologize to us, which we are like, you do not owe us an apology at all. Like, you were amazing. You did this thing for us. And there's no way that you could know that that guy was like cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. She was astonishing the entire time, maintaining her cool over what was difficult situation. So you can see Paisley's fierce intelligence mm-hmm. in this poem. It's not a poem of wit. It's a careful poem. It's a thoughtful poem. But Animal Eye, in of itself as a collection, I tend to come back to a lot that I've never been able to read in one setting
mm-hmm.
because the poems in it are so rich.
Mm.
It's like the poetic equivalent of eating a 5-course meal with wine pairings. Her poems are long.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite intense in attention to detail, and they have these beautifully complex rhetorical arcs. So for this longest night of the year, I wanted to introduce her long meditative poem. And while you listen, I want you to notice the image of the boy and the image of the bird.
For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Nightingale by Paisley Rekdal. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Go to our show notes tab and look for show number 20.
Nightingale by Paisley Rekdal. The boy sits at the kitchen table, pointing through the window at the dark. There is a bird that comes at night, he says, that makes the most beautiful music. Steam off the edges of the field, the gray and brown and green of it, and beyond this, the sea. What does he hear? I imagine it is a nightingale, but I've never heard one. The look on the boy's face as he speaks is the sound of a nightingale. It is the song of a man strapped to his mast, straining and tearing at the straps that bind him. A small breeze moves off the sea. It whistles over the shore, the dark seal shapes that rock in and out of the shoals. It hums there till one of them turns long-necked, broken, and the clothes pull off like hair as the divers drag the changed body out of the sea. The field is wet and full of stars. The boy cocks his head toward the dark. I watch him moving back and forth inside my vision, his body pieces of eye and silk and arm and neck cord. In the story, the man binds himself so that he can listen. He wants to hear the music that will pull him down. He wants to put his head where the heart lives, that small, hard, singing behind a rib cage. Night cuts down through the field. In spring, the mists will burn off, the sea return bright green. I have never seen such a live, dead thing before. I think it is a nightingale. I tell the boy the name, but he only smiles at me. And yet, how is it not a nightingale? Alone, the soft grunt of wings beating behind me, I can sense its gold eye, the throat encrusted with glass. I can hear the water slapping the white sides of the shore. The boy stares out the kitchen window. It hangs like a little square of cold before him, a pane of shadow. The night outside this window is black. The sea is distant. The bird, however I imagine it, sings.
I got the Greek mythology references. I was already scribbling up there. I'm like, oh.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Do you want to start with that?
Well, no, just that I'm very proud of myself. Anytime I can make a connection to a poem you're introducing me to,
yeah,
I'm happy for it.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course, it's the reference to the sirens and to Odysseus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wanted to start with the title, Nightingale, because you can't have a poem called Nightingale without connecting it to Ode to a Nightingale by John Keats.
Okay, I don't know this.
Okay, so this is, do you know John Keats?
Yes.
Okay, so he's a romantic poet, right?
Is he the one who, the center cannot hold?
No.
That's Yeats.
Yeats.
Yeah. Sorry. No, then maybe I don't know this.
So John Keats is a romantic poet.
Mm-hmm.
He actually died in 1821, at the age of 25.
When you say romantic poet,
I
just make the default. Is this an era? What?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So sorry. Here, let me back up. So, yeah, romanticism is a literary and artistic and philosophical movement that originated in the 18th century.
Okay.
It's characterized mostly by emphasis on the imagination and emotions. And marked especially in English literature by the use of autobiographical material, an exaltation of the primitive, an appreciation of nature, but also a predilection for melancholy. So if you want an oversimplified version of that, it's a literary movement that emphasized emotion, nature, and individuality.
Okay.
As opposed to reason, objectivity, you know, these sorts of things. Keats wrote Ode to a Nightingale, which is one of the most famous poems in the English language.
I'll take your word for that.
I learned it in high school.
I dropped out.
Oh, that's right.
Anyways, go ahead. On with yours. But yeah.
Okay. So John Keats is one of the most famous figures of the Romantic era. Partly there's some romanticism, around him as a figure of him writing these great poems, and I mean great in the sense of largeness.
Okay, grand.
Their influence on American literature thereof, and doing that before he died of pulmonary tuberculosis at the age of 25.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean...
I was working in a warehouse at 25.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know what I was doing at 25.
Going to night school too, but...
I think I was having a nervous breakdown at 25. Though I can't help but think of how this poem is in conversation with Keats specifically, Ode to a Nightingale a bit. Now, obviously, Paisley knows that you can't have a poem called Nightingale in English without people thinking of Keats.
I'm nodding my head like, but not of course, like, I'm with you. Obviously, Michael, of course, everybody automatically assumes Keats.
Okay, anybody who's read like the history of literature in poetry, it's also, and it may be particular to me that I have a strong, I mean, it is Nightingale. So Ode to a Nightingale is one of the first poems that made me fall in love with poetry.
Oh.
I encountered it when I was, you know, like a really depressed teenager in high school. And it had such a profound effect on me that I remember walking around the entire rest of the day in a daze, like believing that I had some sort of connection to Keats.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe I knew him in a past life, or I was him in a past life, which was probably some teenage romanticism of the self. At most, I was probably in a past life like his fiance, mm-hmm. Fanny Braun. Right? Like, I was not, but you know, I think there was something about my sort of, yeah, I know.
Fanny Braun.
Fanny Braun.
Muscular butt. Bronny Fanny.
Oh, sorry, Fanny Braun. Yeah, I mean, that does sound like what it means. So she was like,
that's an 18th century porn name. That is not real. She did nude daguerreotypes.
No, but the way that it's often depicted, like, you know, there have been depictions of Keats in movies. What's the name of the movie of Keats? Is it Bright Star? We'll have to look it up. It's a beautiful film. I generally don't like movies about poets because writing, you know, the act of writing is not super fit for cinematic representation.
Well, it's a slow dissolve between the transitions of scenes with a montage of writing. And then
with them like scribbling and looking distantly out of the window to be like, I'm thinking of something brilliant. Like, it just doesn't make for good film. But that particular film I really love. So Fanny Braun is usually depicted as like this kind of healthy girl and Keats as this like skinny tuberculosis driven, like sickly, like
sweat constantly on his pale forehead.
Yes,
probably.
exactly. But so the first lines of that poem are so captivating.
Yeah.
And so exactly like what I was feeling most of the time, that it just rolled me. So the first lines of Ode to a Nightingale are, "My heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains, my sense as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains. 1 minute passed, and lethe words had sunk." It goes on to talk about the sound of the nightingale. "'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thine happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees, in some melodious plot of beechen green and shadows numberless, singest of summer in full-throated ease." So the speaker opens with a declaration of heartache and a sense of confusion, and as if he was intoxicated by some life-threatening poison. He mentions hemlock first, and then opium, and then the waters of Lethe, which is in reference to a Greek mythology. It's the river in Hades, which the souls of the dead drink to forget their life on earth.
And Styx is the Roman name of that river.
Yes, yeah. So then he addresses the nightingale directly, saying that, you know, it's, "You're so happy, I'm feeling pained by my happiness in your happiness." So what you have to imagine is Keats himself writing this, like a young man who's been terribly ill for at least a year at this point, with the same illness that already killed his brother. So he kind of knows what's coming. He knows he's going to die, and he's listening to this incredible sound, the song of a nightingale. And there's this deep awareness here that this might be some of his last memories, right? And he goes so far as to imagine his own death later on in the poem. He says, "Darkling, I listen, and for many a time I have been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many a mused rhyme to take into the air my quiet breath. Now, more than ever, seems it rich to die, to cease upon the midnight with no pain, while thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Still wouldst thou sing, and I have ears in vain, to thy high requiem become a sod."
Darkling, is he addressing somebody? Is that a capital D?
It's a capital D.
Nice.
Yeah, he's addressing the nightingale.
Oh, okay.
"Darkling, I listen. It's so beautiful. So he goes on to describe the bird after this as an immortal, believing the bird has always been there and always will be. The bird eventually goes away, and he's wondering about whether or not he imagined it. Mm-hmm. And so it ends, you know, was it a vision or a waking dream? Fled is that music. Do I wake or sleep? So there's a certain uncertainty about his own perception in this work. You can see this aspect in Nightingale by Paisley Rectall. Mm-hmm. The idea of perception and the idea of imagination is very strong throughout this poem. So I thought we'd now dip into that first line.
Okay.
Now that you know the sort of reference. So the boy sits at the kitchen table pointing through the window at the dark. Any first thoughts?
I mean, it's all just me imagining our kids. Because it's so dark now. We're eating dinner. There's a huge window behind. The shades are up and there's just darkness behind our kids as we eat.
It feels like a winter.
Yeah, but that's the image I'm bringing. That was my first thought.
Yeah. This line sets up the boy. It sets up that it's night, right? So we get the boy, and he's sort of an archetypal character. We don't get a name.
Mm.
Later on, we get kind of a description. Here is the first clue that the poem must be in part about perception, the ability to actually perceive with our senses versus the ability of the imagination, and then how both work together in the mind. Because the very next line says, there is a bird that comes at night, he says, that makes the most beautiful music. He draws our attention to a thing that is there in one sense, hearing,
mm-hmm.
but not in another, sight.
Mm-hmm.
And then it moves on to steam off the edges of the field, the gray and brown and green of it, and beyond this, the sea. She mentions two potential edges here, the edge of the field and the sea, where the speaker doesn't mention, but what we might immediately imagine as a shoreline.
Right, right.
The transitional spaces of two landscapes, what one of which is steaming, right? And the other we might imagine spraying because it's a shoreline, right? It's a sea. The speaker manages to evoke mist and fog without saying either thing.
Right.
But the whole thing is
otherworldly. There's something,
yes.
There's something netherworldly.
Yes.
Beyond the glass.
Yeah. I mean, I almost imagine like clouds of ether. Or something floating around with this, and it's dark, that there's something about this whole scene that seems haunted in some way. And then a simple question, what does he hear? I imagine it is a nightingale, but have never heard one.
And I identified with that line, but I do too. Wait a minute, I've not heard one either.
Yeah, I know, I felt the same way, despite having like read Ode to a Nightingale a million times. But these lines, we established that the speaker doesn't have access to the sound of the bird, right? She's now trying to imagine what the boy hears.
Which, I mean, I bracketed the next.
Yeah.
I think that's incredibly, the next two lines are beautiful.
Oh, yeah. They're stunning, right? The look on the boy's face as he speaks is the sound of a nightingale.
Is the sound. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Like, because she's giving a visual image for the sonic image, right?
Of something she has not heard. So it's just, yes. This boy's also giving a very strange, unfamiliar look at her as well.
Yes. And I think in, to go back to this earlier moment, I think it's significant that I imagine that there's a line break there.
Mm-hmm.
You notice like just kind of eyeing the poem really quick.
What does he hear, I imagine? Almost like that rolls together and the question mark would be, but you're right, it's the line break.
The line break emphasizes, I imagine, line break, it is a nightingale, but have never heard one. And I think the idea of the imagination is really potent throughout this piece,
mm-hmm.
and that having a line break at that particular moment will end up being significant. That she's definitely drawing our attention again to the idea of perceiving. I imagine it is a nightingale, but I've never heard one.
Mm.
For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Nightingale by Paisley Rectall. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Go to the show notes tab and find show number 20.
Okay.
The look on the boy's face as he speaks is the sound of a nightingale, which is just gorgeous. It is the song of a man strapped to his mast, straining and tearing at the straps that bind him. And you thought,
well, that's definitely when I checked off. Yeah.
Well, do you want to say what you were?
Well, the hearing the sirens call, that he wanted to experience it. He strapped himself and had his crew stuff their ears full of wax and cotton and such. And while he got to, what did he hear? It was his family, or he heard loved ones calling him, but beyond it being beautiful.
Oh, I thought it was his like the great deeds he would do. His victories to come, his conquest. That's what I thought it was. I'm really curious to know which one it is, because those are two are very different things. Okay, the siren.
You might be pulling from the book. I'm pulling from Michael Douglas. Kurt Douglas, I mean.
What? What are you talking about?
I mean Kurt Douglas in the movie, in the adaptation.
I've never seen this.
It's old. Anyways, I saw it as a kid. That's how I got introduced to this particular myth.
My favorite adaptation of Odysseus is the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Oh, brother, where art thou?
I was so slow to pick up when I was watching.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I seen. It's so funny. Penelope.
Well, it took Matt Barisi going, of course there's a Cyclops. I'm like, what are you talking about? And they give me a look like, are you a complete idiot? And I obviously am. Anyhow.
So tearing at the straps that bind him, a small breeze moves off the sea. It whistles over the shore, the dark seal shapes that rock in and out of the shoals. This is, I think, a particularly beautiful passage. And I think what makes it so beautiful are the S and SH sounds, mm-hmm. which are sounds we associate with seascapes.
Mm-hmm.
Small, sea, whistles, shore, seal shapes, shoals. And notice at the end, so shoals is just another word for a school of fish.
Mm-hmm.
But notice she didn't use schools, right? School mm-hmm. of fish, which would have ruined the musicality that she's setting up here. Shoals is much more perfect for the sounds mm-hmm. that she's creating. And then it goes on, it hums there till one of them turns long-necked, broken, and the clothes pull off like hair as the divers drag the changed body out of the sea.
What? Like, so we've had a mood change, or not, like suddenly people are sitting up in their chairs.
Yes.
Sorry, suddenly I'm sitting up in my chair as I was reading this. And the word for that's autolysis.
Autolysis?
Yeah, it's basically when your skin sloughs off. Off a corpse.
Oh, God.
So like when you pull somebody from a river, it's when you...
I hate when there are technical words for things like that. You're like, oh, this happens.
This was my undergrad.
I know.
Anyway, so
physical
yeah,
anthropology.
You grab somebody's arms and then suddenly you're pulling off two gloves.
No! This is horrific.
Okay. Okay. That's way... Okay. It's uglier than the story, but she has it. It's much more beautiful the way she says it. Pulling off like hair.
It's the clothes that are pulling off like hair, not the skin.
And the clothes pull off like hair
as the divers drag the changed body out of the sea.
Oh, you're right. Why did I think it was skin? Okay.
Gross.
Just bring in my own baggage. Okay, I'm sorry. You take back over. You take the wheel.
I'm taking the wheel back.
Okay.
You're drunk. You're not drunk.
Just morbid.
So there's an extreme transformation happening mm-hmm. here, a physical transformation into brokenness, and it seems into death. It, we assume, is that small breeze humming over, hums there till one of them turns long-necked. And then, you know, the divers end up taking the bodies out of the sea, or the body out mm-hmm. of the sea.
Yeah.
So you have this understanding that whoever was strapped to the mast does not survive the straining to hear, right? That they are sort of consumed by the ocean. That almost like they've broken their own neck trying to get out.
Oh.
Turns long-necked, broken, and the clothes pull off like hair as the divers drag the changed body out of the sea. And then the simple transition into the field is wet and full of stars, which would be stunningly beautiful in of itself. But here there's this sort of dark light thing happening. I mean, right. Not only in the image itself, the wet field and the sky full of stars, but to say that directly after mentioning a dead body being dredged out of the water, you know, you're like, oh, okay, all right, we're paying attention to the field now. I'm still kind of there.
So it's pre-dawn, early morning. The fields are steaming. There's little dew is everywhere.
Well, no, there's dark. She says at the very beginning, the boy stares out the window at the dark. It's night.
But we talk about steam off the edges of the field. That's usually a morning.
Not necessarily.
Like pre-dawn, false dawn could be happening.
Yeah, I suppose so. Could be.
Maybe the window's out to the east. Sorry, west.
Yeah, I mean, the palm seems to, especially at the end there, seem to be utterly in the dark.
Okay.
Which we can get to later. But there is a sort of play of time and scene and a question about whether or not this is actually attached to reality.
Yeah, because I actually had not made the connection between Ulysses straining and the body being pulled up.
And I could be totally wrong there. That's how I'm reading it, because it's closest to that mass. But one of them turns long neck broken. It could be referencing something else, and I'm just not getting it. But then we get this really peculiar image of the boy.
Yeah.
The boy cocks his head toward the dark. I watch him moving back and forth inside my vision, his body, pieces of eye and silk and arm and neck cord.
Yeah, neck cord.
Yeah, and also the oddness of cocking your head and moving back and forth. It's very bird-like movements. Mm-hmm. Feels like, here is where I begin to question if there actually ever was a boy.
Ah.
The speaker says, inside my vision, which makes me think the boy might be a thing of the imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
That he is becoming what he hears, a bird.
Ah.
Suddenly looking back, you might think, wait a minute. Does this boy have a name? Who is the speaker? Why are they in a dark kitchen? Why did they just mention some dead bodies being dragged out and moving it? Is this entire thing a vision? I'm fine with all of those questions because I feel like the poem is leading me through an enactment of perceiving, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yes. That makes sense. I was just kind of going with dream logic, kind of.
Right.
I actually, the first time when we were talking about the movement of the boy, I imagined it filmed backwards and accelerated.
Oh,
so
really?
His jerky little weird movements as he, like, slightly unnatural, because it's he moved one way and the film was shown backwards. And
well, yeah. I mean, there is something weird about it, right? Mm-hmm. His body pieces of.
That kid is off.
Eye and silk and arm and neck cord. At this point, when I arrived at this idea that maybe the poem is about perceiving, it actually does lead me back to Keats, specifically Keats's idea of what he calls negative capability, which was written in a letter to his brothers many years actually before he published the Ode to a Nightingale. And it refers to the ability of a poet to receive and be the transmitter of truth and beauty. To quote him directly, he said that the poet must be, quote, capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason.
Well, there's a great trouble in the world that people who hate mysteries. Well, people who have to have absolutes.
Right.
And they hate mysteries in that if it's it, but they have to have some answer, even if simplistic or ridiculous.
Right.
No, this must be explained. And they'll simply say, God made it.
No, I think I understand what you're saying, which is that people who want absolutes are impatient about being in any state
intolerant.
Of confusion. They're intolerant.
That's they tend to not like gay people. Just like, because that's not normal. I mean, like anything, like ambiguity. you know.
Yeah, any ambiguity, any gray area, right? They want there to be
binary. They want to exist in a binary black and white world.
Right. Where most of the world does not exist.
No. Yeah.
And so I think that what Keats is talking about here, I mean, I don't think he's saying to like completely let go necessarily of reason, but to be able to dwell in doubt. Now, some people sometimes see this quote as they misconstrue the quote as poets being somehow like passive.
Mm. Passive receptors of this?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So that's not what he means mm-hmm. here. I mean, in that scene, you know, you can sort of imagine him like lounging around on, I don't know, I guess like a blue velvet chaise. Coughing and rosy cheeked, waiting for a poem to descend upon him like Patrick Swayze's ghost, you know, just.
But he's at the pottery wheel.
Yes, exactly. Oh, yeah, sorry. No, he's not at the chase. He's clearly the pottery wheel.
And coughing into this receptacle
and
parts of his lung.
And Patrick
Swayze's behind him. Yeah. Because Patrick Swayze's okay with mysteries.
But he doesn't mean this. He doesn't mean any kind of laziness. He means actually an intense attention without the judgments that the reasonable mind constantly assails us with, right? That reasonable voice that tells you not to pay attention to your dreams or thinks it's stupid or lazy to stare at a tree, mm-hmm. Or the rational voice that hurries you along instead of stopping to take a breath and thinking about your life or where you are or what you find beautiful. So the poet's job, he thinks, which he calls negative capability, he means it as a comment on the poetic process. To arrive at an original thought, you have to be okay with dwelling in a kind of luxurious confusion.
Hmm.
You know, because you can't arrive at originality without seeing things anew. To see something truly new, you have to be confused.
Okay, luxurious confusion?
Yeah.
Is that yours?
Yes.
Beautiful. Name of your next collection.
Luxurious Confusion. It's the name of my life right now. To return to this idea of
I think right now, your life right now is a richness of confusion.
Is that? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, we're not quite in luxury.
No.
So the phrase negative capability has come to sort of stand in for an attitude of accepting whatever may be received while in a state of intense heightened awareness. Mm. To go back to this poem here, to think through this poem, through this, I see this poem as being an enactment mm-hmm. of negative capability to give rich attention to a particular moment and the act of perceiving mm-hmm. in of itself without any irritable reaching after fact or reason.
Okay.
Then after this description of the boy who seems like he's sort of blending with the bird, she goes back to in the story, the man binds himself so that he can listen. He wants to hear the music that will pull him down. He wants to put his head where the heart lives, that small, hard singing behind a rib cage, which is amazing. Night cuts down through the field. It moves on. In spring, the mists will burn off, the sea return bright green. I have never seen such a live, dead thing before. Which I think that she's talking about the sea here
mm-hmm.
and or the field, since the mists will burn off. It's such a beautiful evocation of the kind of spirit of the natural world mm-hmm. in some way, right? Even when everything is dormant, that it's still quite bright.
Right.
And then she brings us back to the beginning, right? I think it is a nightingale. I tell the boy the name, but he only smiles at me.
Which is so cryptic.
I know.
And it could be like, he just smiles because he doesn't understand.
Or he smiles because he knows and was waiting for you to say it.
Or because it was like, oh, you're so simple. You don't get the bigger mysteries. I mean, like, there's anything like a cryptic smile from a child. Like, what are you thinking? For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Nightingale by Paisley Rekdal. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Go to our show notes tab and look for show number 20.
I tell the boy the name, but he only smiles at me. And yet, how is it not a nightingale? And then this gorgeous section. I mean,
a grunt of wings.
Yes. Yeah. No. It's such an intense, intense image, sonic image throughout this. Right. Alone, the soft grunt of wings beating behind me. I can sense its gold eye, the throat encrusted with glass. Oh my God! So amazing. Like, this is not an imagined thing now, or rather, it is a fully imagined thing.
Right.
Right. It has a physicality to it. It has a weight. It's making a sound in her head. I can hear the water slapping the white sides of the shore. The boy stares out the kitchen window. It hangs like a little square of cold before him, a pane of shadow. The night outside this shadow is black. The sea is distant. The bird, however I imagine it, sings.
Oh, and the night outside is black. Okay, obviously, yes, nighttime. Yeah. I retract my earlier.
But there's something about this boy. He's part, at some point,
avian.
Yeah, well, at the beginning, I just take the speaker's word for it that it's a boy.
Mm-hmm.
At some point later on, her description of him sounds as if he is sort of transforming in her vision to a nightingale. And then when she says, you know, it's a nightingale, and he just smiles at her, I mean, I almost feel like, and this is way reaching and way going beyond the text, way going beyond the text. Nobody should take this as any kind of real thing. I feel like he's the ghost of Keats. There's something about her just saying the boy.
Well, if Keats died of tuberculosis, right?
Yes.
So obviously coughed up blood. Somebody with a throat coated in glass would cough up blood.
But that's not what that image is about. That's about
the
sheen of the bird's throat, right? There's something about the boy that feels like he's not a real boy to me. That
old spirit?
Well, I mean, she calls him the boy, so he has an archetypal presence.
Hmm.
But also, I mean, Keats was so young when he died, and he was so young when he fell in love with poetry. When he wrote the stuff about negative capability, I mean, if he wrote that in a letter in 1912 and...
He was six?
No, I think he was a little bit older than that, but I mean, it was so precocious, right? The very ending of this returns us to the opening line. He's trying to see. He's straining to hear it. What will happen if he sees the thing he loves to hear? And this ending is this oblique ending. Like, she's calling our attention to what we can't understand or what we can't perceive, at the same time that she's talking about her imagination of the thing. In this last line, the bird, however I imagine it, comma, sings. The syntactical construction once again draws our attention to perception itself and to imagination as a mode of perceiving, however I imagine it.
Oh, okay.
Right? It suggests the actual bird and the speaker's imagination of the bird are kind of equal in the mind of the speaker. The bird sings however the speaker imagines it.
Mm.
There is a bird, and I can't know it except through how I imagine it sings in some ways. So Keats believed that poetry's highest aim is to express beauty and to discard lesser forms of knowledge. So he understands beauty, the transmitting and receiving of beauty, as a kind of knowledge in of itself.
Mm-hmm. When he says, what would be a lesser knowledge than beauty? Knowing beauty is the highest knowledge?
That's the most important thing that a poet can do.
Okay.
The idea of beauty as a kind of knowledge in of itself, I really love. He understood it to apply only to a poet's process, but I like to extrapolate something in the structure there to think about also readers of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there's a similar state, that a similar state is necessary for readers of poetry, or perhaps audiences of any art, that in order to enjoy it, they have to be able to dwell a little in confusion.
Mm-hmm.
That they are, to quote Keats again, are capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Now, obviously, through a close read of the poem, you do a lot of irritable reaching after fact, right? But in the first read, in a poetic introduction to a poem, you have to be kind of open to dwell in mystery,
mm-hmm.
and to take pleasure from the beauty of the work first, and then take pleasure in the analysis of it. And so I hope that we can return to this reading of this poem,
mm-hmm.
and that it will be a beautiful meditation for you in the longest night of the year.
Oh, you're talking to the listeners now.
At this particular moment, yeah.
Okay. I was like, uh-huh, and oh. I'm like, I'm going to be with you on the longest night of the year.
I know. You looked so sweetly at me in that particular moment.
I was like, this is beautiful. And I'm like, oh, it's, you're talking to them. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I will be with you on the longest night of the year. I don't think I'm going anywhere
and
on Friday.
We will, after the boys go to sleep. You'll read this to me, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But in this particular moment.
Right. So maybe you should hit it with another read.
Okay, great.
If you want to read along with the poem, just go to our website, litfromthebasement.com, click on the show notes tab along the top, and then look for show number 20.
Nightingale by Paisley Rekdal. The boy sits at the kitchen table, pointing through the window at the dark. There is a bird that comes at night, he says, that makes the most beautiful music. Steam off the edges of the field, the gray and brown and green of it, and beyond this, the sea. What does he hear? I imagine it is a nightingale, but I've never heard one. The look on the boy's face as he speaks is the sound of a nightingale. It is the song of a man strapped to his mast, straining and tearing at the straps that bind him. A small breeze moves off the sea. It whistles over the shore, the dark seal shapes that rock in and out of the shoals. It hums there till one of them turns long-necked, broken, and the clothes pull off like hair as the divers drag the changed body out of the sea. The field is wet and full of stars. The boy cocks his head toward the dark. I watch him moving back and forth inside my vision, his body pieces of eye and silk and arm and neck cord. In the story, the man binds himself so that he can listen. He wants to hear the music that will pull him down. He wants to put his head where the heart lives, that small, hard singing behind a rib cage. Night cuts down through the field. In spring, the mists will burn off, the sea return bright green. I have never seen such a live, dead thing before. I think it is a nightingale. I tell the boy the name, but he only smiles at me. And yet, how is it not a nightingale? Alone, the soft grunt of wings beating behind me. I can sense its gold eye, the throat encrusted with glass. I can hear the water slapping the white sides of the shore. The boy stares out the kitchen window. It hangs like a little square of cold before him, a pane of shadow. The night outside this window is black. The sea is distant. The bird, however I imagine it, sings.
Yeah, I know we don't have time to keep talking much more, but quick things that I caught the second time through. Seal shapes that rock in and out. Well, if they're not seals, they could very well be the sirens.
Yeah, it sort of depends on what depiction of the sirens you're talking about. So in early
Kelpies. Or Selkies. Sorry, Kelpies. Yeah, Selkies. I mean, if we're near the fields, I'm imagining... I don't know why I'm thinking Scotland and Ireland for some reason.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
But nothing in here says that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be depending on which version. So in the earliest version of Greek mythology, of Greek art, the sirens are depicted as birds with the heads of women.
Harpies. Harpies have the upper torsos of women.
Oh, okay.
And their arms go into wings. But okay, anyways.
And then in later versions, they're combined with fish. And so mermaids.
Okay.
And that's what we usually think of. But yeah, it depends on what time of Greek mythology you want to look up. But yeah, that's the first thing I thought too. I was like, are there mermaids here? Are there selkies?
And then I don't know how I wasn't super startled by, he wants to put his head where his heart lives, that small heart singing behind the rib cage. I'm like, why did I not super circle that the first time through?
It's gorgeous, right?
And then now I finally get the throat encrusted with glass because it's crystalline, prismatic, multifaceted.
Yes.
Sharp pitched, possibly.
Yeah.
Or sound. It's
yeah.
It's a
yeah, that's a good point.
When I'm trying to like translate that to, what is it? Synesthesia?
Synesthesia.
Yeah, like you hear smells,
yes.
Feel sound, and
well, that happens in the poem earlier too. With the very first time image that we get, the look on the boy's face as he speaks is the sound of a nightingale, right?
Yeah,
he looks like a sound.
Yeah. Okay, we're over, and I've got to trim so much of this out. But our theme music is by Status Q.
We have links on our homepage for you to subscribe to our show on iTunes and Spotify. You can also subscribe through the Google Play Store.
Our show notes have their own tab on our website. There you can find a copy of the work we discussed, the link to purchase the work, author information, and anything else we thought might be relevant.
If you have a comment, suggestion, correction, or alternate reading of the poem, just send us a message by using our contact page.
If you want to hear Danielle read some of her work, click on the Vanity Press tab on our website. Okay, it's too late to build a fire. But we'll definitely have one on the darkest night.
This poem and some fire, a little bit of warmth. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Take care. Stay warm. Be with somebody on the long night.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Oh, and by the way, Mercer today headed me off. I adjusted the rearview mirror as I do sometimes, just to see what he's doing as I'm driving him to school.
Yeah.
And he was looking out the window, and I adjusted the mirror down, and it was at a red light, so I was just kind of staring at him, and he never looked up, never gave me a clue that he knew I was looking at him. And he said, "I'm not thinking about anything."
Because you always ask him what he's thinking.
Not always. Or apparently now, I guess, maybe he perceives it that I'm always asking him because he's very in his own world and staring out the window. He had a very neutral look on his face. But I could have gotten a smile. Yeah, I just could have gotten a smile like that from him.